I am curious, in this, the era of podcasting, how does it feel to just be doing a TV show? Does that depress you, knowing that you're the wave of the past?
It doesn't depress me at all. Yeah. You know, if it wasn't for the visual element of the telly that we are doing, you know, then I would never get to dress up. I mean, right now, your listeners don't realize that we're both sitting here pantsless having this conversation.
Trevor Noah, host of The Daily Show, is a seriously funny and a seriously smart man. He also brings to his job a sui generis view of America, our politics, our customs, our obsessions.
It's all about statistics. Have you seen sports in America? Nonstop. You know everything. You know everything. And then you switch over to like your business channels and your economy, and you're like, what's happening in the economy this year, Bob?
Well, no, nobody knows. I mean...
Noah grew up as a mixed-race kid in South Africa during the final years of apartheid. When he holds a mirror up to America for us to see, it's almost as if it's a two-way mirror. Yes, he's an outsider dwelling on the differences, but he often zeroes in on the similarities.
The people with the longest history of getting f***ed over in America are the ones who are getting f***ed over. Like, this is the conversation. The conversation seems to go, the pipeline is completely safe. And it's like, well, then why didn't you build it under the white people's houses? Well, because it might leak. So it's not safe. It's just safe enough for the Native Americans. No, it's not a race thing. It's that if the pipe leaks, there's fewer of them than of us. And why are there fewer of them?
Noah has been in the States for 5 years now. A major highlight, interviewing President Obama.
Yeah, I'd like to apologize, first of all. I know you've waited a long time for this and you wanted to make this happen. I'm sorry.
You guys wouldn't book us. I kept on calling.
And Noah was one of the few people who talk for a living who didn't discount the possibility of Donald Trump becoming president. Nor did he explain Trump's election in the usual fashion.
When you look at the election results, the color red doesn't necessarily mean white power. It can also mean there are people who wanted the world to pay attention to them.
Today on Freakonomics Radio, Trevor Noah on politics, race, religion, and his excellent new memoir, Born a Crime.
I was the first person in my family who was allowed to go to a white school or a school that was considered white.
From WNYC Studios, this is Freakonomics Radio, the show that explores the hidden side of everything. Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
I would think that comedians around the world are going to be very pissed off at you because rather than just writing up a book of all your comedy stuff, which is what they usually do, you went and actually wrote a real book, which raises the bar.
Oh, wow, thank you. Most people would see it as a book about me growing up in apartheid. It's not really that. Apartheid was merely the container that my life existed within. If anything, it's a story of myself and my mom. And, you know, it's a crazy journey that we lived through together.
Trevor Noah was born in South Africa in 1984. His mother was black and African. His father, white and European. This meant that Noah was technically born a crime, the title of his book. The rules of apartheid dictated that neither his mother nor father could publicly acknowledge this mixed-race boy as their son. His mother, if asked, would pretend she was his babysitter. His father literally ran away from him on the street if he started shouting, "Daddy, Daddy." Noah grew up primarily with his mother and her family in the black township of Soweto. He was very poor, but also much loved, much encouraged. And he was good at many things, language, sports, making people laugh, and taking the temperature of a room.
You write as a kid that you really became a chameleon linguistically, yeah, but in other ways too, and that you use that to your advantage. You wrote that the way to bridge the gap between different people was their language and so on. So is chameleon essentially always a good thing?
Or yeah, I think so. Fundamentally, a chameleon may change its color, but it's still a chameleon. You know, and that's really what a chameleon is doing. A chameleon is for me doing two things. It is blending into its environment to protect itself, but also so as not to disturb the environment and to create a panic.
Now, what if someone said, well, that means that you're not being your authentic self? Is that a concern?
Oh, it doesn't concern me at all. What you're saying is my authentic self is one thing.
Mm-hmm,
why does that need to be?
Yeah.
So could you not see the same person as being, think of a parent. A parent is a provider, but at the same time, they're a protector. A parent is someone who provides love, but also discipline. A parent, you get what I'm saying?
Yeah.
You can be many things at the same time whilst authentically being yourself.
So your mom is remarkable, and she obviously taught you a lot, and you learned a lot from her, and you learned a lot on your own as well. She talked about one of her greatest hopes was that you wouldn't have to pay what she called a black tax.
Yeah.
That you'd have to work harder than a white person just to get back to zero.
Yes.
And that generationally that can even compound on itself. Talk to me for a minute about that concept of the black tax there in South Africa versus here now.
Well, if you think of it like this, you know, a lot of the time when you hear people having conversations about white privilege, you know, male privilege and so on, I think sometimes what gets lost is with the word privilege comes the connotation of having a good time. You know, people go, what privilege? I may be a white man, but I'm poor. I may be a white man, but I'm suffering. And that is completely true. And sometimes I go, maybe it in the labeling, it's almost like it could have gone the other way. And it's like, is it a black disadvantage or is it a female disadvantage? Because we cannot deny that there are certain handicaps that come with these certain labels, you know, that exist. And if you look at the effects of what you've lived through in your life, you cannot deny that they compound. You cannot deny that they grow over time. So people who say things like, get over it, slavery's done, or get over it, apartheid is over, then I go, you cannot get over it because it ending is merely the beginning of your journey. And so you think of it like this. In my family, I was the first person in my family who was allowed to go to a white school or a school that was considered white. My grandparents were not taught the things that other people's grandparents were taught if they were white in the country. And so now, even if we're not talking about financial inheritance, we're talking about now educational inheritance. My grandfather and grandmother couldn't bequeath to me an education that they would have learned because they didn't get it. My mother, self-taught for many things, she was lucky in that she encountered a missionary. And that's where she learned things that the government wasn't teaching to many black people. So there you see someone equalizing or trying to, you know, get her back to zero, which is where everyone should be able to start from.
But she was also, I mean, look, to be frank, your mother was singularly, maybe not singularly, extraordinarily driven
for
her own life. She wanted to have a child, even if there wasn't a marriage,
definitely.
And that child was you. And then the extent to which she made sure to, I mean, literally invest in you, take you to places that cost nothing, expose you to things that cost nothing, expose you to languages and help teach you languages. So, you know,
but that's an example of my mother working extra hard to make sure that I was at least at the zero level that a child who was not black would be at. And that's what I'm saying is she was trying to make sure that I wasn't in a place where I would now have to pay back in essence for things that I didn't have access to beforehand.
So that's fantastic for you, fantastic for her, and she's obviously to be applauded for that. But on the other hand, because she is such an outlier, you have to think about, well, when the system itself doesn't provide for that opportunity for everybody, what do you do? So I'm just curious. I do think that you think about our society, including race, very differently.
I think it's because I've been lucky enough to live all over the world. So South Africa birthed me, South Africa raised me. But then I spent a lot of time living elsewhere, you know, so I've gotten to spend cumulatively a year living in the UK. I've got to spend 6 months in Australia. I got to spend now 5 years living in the US. I've gotten to spend so much time living in different places, even experiencing what it means to be black in different places. And so with that comes a different way of processing information. With that comes a different way of trying to understand what we're dealing with in the world, whether it comes to, like you say, these systems that oppress people and these ideas that are designed to hold people back.
This is the strangest thing. They asked all the weird questions, questions that have nothing to do with a man being shot who is unarmed. And they come in and go, also noted is that Walter Scott owed $16,000 in child support. To the cop.
So you were very, very religious as a child.
Yes.
And then as a Christian, as a Roman Catholic, but then your mom converted to Judaism. What's your religious situation now?
I'm spiritual. I think what constantly throws me with religion is the taint of man, I find. You know,
humankind, you mean, or yeah, maleness?
That as well, because a lot of religion is framed around patriarchy. You know, it's men using this mythical thing to oppress other people and women. You know, most religions aren't very very progressive in terms of women's rights.
Although it's women that are covering up the eras in which they were formed.
Oh, yeah,
of course,
yeah, right, definitely. Right. Yeah. But what I'm saying is there's just not even one religion where it's just like, no, men need to cover up more and men are the ones that are dirty and men are the ones that, do you get what I'm saying?
Maybe you should start one.
Maybe
this Daily Show thing is just a way station on the route to starting, what would you call your religion?
What would I call my religion? The Church of the Truth. That's what I would call it.
Very shooting small.
It's got a catchy name, right?
That's right.
Yeah, where do you go? I go to the Church of the Truth.
Do you still pray?
I do.
What do you pray for? I realize it's an intimate question you don't have to answer.
I see prayer as a form of meditation. So essentially, you know, when I look across religions, I find a common thread. And I go, you know, so if you look at a person who's meditating, that's no different to what a lot of people who worship, you know, under Islam are doing five times a day. They're taking time out of their day and getting into a zone. And that's really what prayer is for me. You know, it's taking a moment to be mindful, thinking about your world, thinking about your day, visualizing, thinking about a future, thinking about the past.
Is there a deity involved?
Not necessarily. I think, again, that's where man has attached himself to the God, you know? I think if there is a God, it's something we cannot understand. It is far beyond our comprehension of what we would think, because we make it like it's just like basically a big version of Santa Claus who decides who gets gifts and who doesn't.
So what would you do if you were a God, whether you have your own religion,
well,
Church of the
I don't
Truth
know if I'd give people free will. That's like, you know, that's why,
really?
That's why I don't think I'd be a good God.
That's a big one to take right off the table.
Yeah, I don't think I would. Why would you give the people the will to hurt you? That makes no sense to me. And that's why I say God must be beyond everything we conceive if there is a God. Because I wouldn't let you choose to do the thing that would hurt me. Why would I want that?
You sound like someone who grew up under a very repressive dictator, a very repressive government, I have to say.
It sounds like you're talking about apartheid, but I'm talking about my mom. Yes, I did. Very, very oppressive regime. That was my mother.
Coming up after the break, Trevor Noah does Donald Trump.
These people, they want to change. And we're going to, you know, that's what we're going to do. We're going to make America great again.
And he explains why he's not interested in being as angry as his predecessor, Jon Stewart.
You're trying to win. Your anger doesn't help you win. Half of the time, it sends you into a blind rage.
That's coming up on Freakonomics Radio.
From WNYC Studios, this is Freakonomics Radio. Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
Trevor Noah, born a crime in South Africa, has achieved personal success beyond what he ever could have conceived. It was stand-up comedy that made it happen.
Why do you guys censor your hip-hop on hip-hop radio stations? I understand when I listen to Kiss, they played a hip-hop song, and then they censor. I was like, okay, maybe some people don't like. But then on the hip-hop station, they censor hip-hop. Why would you do that? It's a hip-hop station. Surely everyone listening to the hip-hop station knows what hip-hop is all about. Like, is there somebody listening to hip-hop who doesn't like the cussing particularly? Who are the people that made these laws? Who was that person who was like, you know what, I can't handle the cussing. I just can't handle it. Please, cut it out. But keep the misogyny. Keep that in.
America has a lot of conversations lately about diversity and what that means. And there are some people who argue, and I tend to agree with them, that often people talk about diversity in terms of the most observable characteristics.
Yes.
Skin color is very observable, gender, et cetera, et cetera. And that those characteristics may actually be emblematic of something that's not all that substantial, whereas the less observable characteristics inside of a person, which may be much more significant, how people think religiously, politically, how they think about the military, on and on, those are, because they're not observable, we kind of don't count them in terms of diversity. So what you may end up with in the kind of modern American form of diversity is a bunch of people who may look fairly different,
yes,
but think exactly alike, as opposed to a bunch of people who have different thoughts and may or may not look alike. And I'm curious whether you think what I just stated is true in your experience, and if so, what you think is a better way to think about it.
Well, I think it's complicated and none of us have figured it out. What I will say is this. Within that world, the one thing you're negating is the fact that what you feel or think about the world is not mutually exclusive from what the world thinks or feels about you. So if you have a room, let's say you have a room of only purple people, they may all have different religions, they may all have different beliefs about the economy and the military and so on, but the one thing they all have in common is they're all purple. And so it stands to reason that they've all shared similar experiences in and around being purple. So the way the world reacts to them is as purple people. And so although it may not be perfect, when you have a room of different colors, what happens is each of those colors has interacted with the world in a different way, because unfortunately that's what the world is like now. So there is an element of that. What you're saying is completely true. And there is no fix-all, I think, but you cannot deny that that is something that also informs you and changes who you are.
I very much see your point, and I agree with your point. I guess the bigger challenge is when you say it's hard to fix that or it's hard to change it. Again, the scholars that I'm thinking of would say, well, that is true, but the first thing you have to do is realize that the human brain makes decisions all the time based on shortcuts that are kind of bad ways of thinking, you know?
that makes sense.
And that wouldn't it be great if, rather than saying, you know, I'm going to group these people alike because they're all purple or white or black, whatever, I'm going to actually try to figure out some kind of litmus test of my own to think, are these good people or are these honest people, these trustworthy people?
You are right in saying that there are many different measures, but when there are issues that are aimed at people, when there are, you know, when you've got voter ID laws, let's say, that are aimed specifically, as the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals said, at specific people who are marked by the color of their skin, why not get a person of that color to give you the feeling or the opinion behind it? And I think that's where diversity plays in, because I think of it as a competitive advantage. I don't think of it as like a moral thing, in fact. I go, diversity is great for your competition. It makes you better. It makes you think. That's what makes America great. I don't think it's any mistake that America has so much innovation, because you're living in a society that is not homogenous. You're living in a society that has so many different influences. So you have a Russian coming in to create Google, but from America, because his mind comes from a Russian place, but then he is basically infected with the goodness that is in America in terms of just different ideas, you know, and that's what it is. In terms of diversity, is you bring your experiences, I bring mine. We may combine those two things to come up with something that you alone and I alone could not have come up with.
So let me ask you this. It's been said by eggheads, whom I admire, that one of the best ingredients in a healthy civilization is social trust and social capital. And that in America, it's been quite on decline since the 1960s or so, as it has been in Britain. I'm just curious, you look at this country, if I tell you the fact that our social trust is relatively much lower than it used to be, and you've come in as an outsider, Tocquevillian in some ways, how would you think about repairing, uplifting social trust? Keeping in mind, sorry, I left out one thing, keeping in mind that one of the biggest barriers to social trust is diversity. Social trust in and of itself isn't so great. It can exist in a place.
Yes.
But that group could be hostile to everyone else. You know, ideally, you want social trust and diversity. What the scholars say is, well, you look at the institutions that do a good job of creating that between people who are different. Universities, sports teams. I mean, you box. Did you play team sports, though?
Yeah, I did.
Yeah.
Is it maybe because in those institutions, you feel like you have a common goal and a common purpose? And maybe essentially the people in this country don't feel like they have a common goal and a common purpose.
So if that were the case, and let's just say it is, and you could help define the common goal or purpose of America for the next 5 or 10 years, what would it be?
This is the thing. I think it's more a question. Over the next 4 years, America is going to have to answer the question, and that is, who is America? Is America the land of the free and the home of the brave? Is America that shining tower on a hill? Or is America the capitalistic, take as much as possible, burn as much fuel as possible, plunder where necessary in the world and oppress the weaker? Is that America? Or is America a little bit of both? And I think that is closer to where you know, once you get that answer, because oftentimes you see in the conversations that are had between people, that is still something that people don't agree on, is what America actually is.
But you said something earlier about America that I think most people would agree with, is the diversity is what makes us different, what makes us innovative, right?
And what makes it more difficult.
Well, true, absolutely. But part of diversity means, you know, what they call heterogeneous preferences, right? People prefer different things. So what if America remains divided, the way we call it that, people, a lot of different people having a lot of different preferences, but finding a way to unite under a common goal, in other words, the long-term goal, the definition of what America is.
Yeah, well, I will put it like this, on a smaller level. Think of a music festival. Everyone can go to a music festival and have a really great time. All the people are there together because they are in the common goal, they share a common goal, and that is to enjoy and appreciate music. Now, some people will go to the hip-hop stage, some people will go to the rock stage, others will go to the indie alternative stage, some will go to all three.
What about the podcast stage?
But it's a music festival, you're killing me here. But the point is, everybody at least has agreed that they are in this for music. They want to appreciate music. And that's why I say the larger thing still becomes within that world. Yeah, you all want everything that is different, but what is the one common goal that you are striving for? You know, and so I feel like to a certain extent, maybe countries where they're good at doing that, you know, like Japan has a culture in and around that. Germany has a culture. I mean, they had it a bit too much, you know, a little bit of über alles, but the point is everyone was aimed in the same direction. Right. And I think that's where you start to realize, you know, how that can move you forward.
In 2015, Noah was chosen by Comedy Central to replace Jon Stewart when he stepped down as host of The Daily Show. Do you like your job now?
Yeah, I love my job. It's challenging. It's extremely difficult.
I'm told that you were a little bit surprised by just how exhaustive and exhausting it is running the show editorially.
Yeah. I'll tell you this. Jon Stewart he gets amazing credit. But one piece of credit, and I tell them all the time, is I go, you are a genius. You are a genius, and you are one of the hardest working people I've ever come across, because this thing is a monster to move. It is a mountain, because it's one thing to make jokes every day. It's another thing to be in a world where you're making jokes. You're also trying to, do research. You're trying to forge a point of view. You're trying to be truthful whilst at the same time getting across a feeling and connecting with an audience. There are many things happening at the same time. Oftentimes I go, man, I wish we could just make jokes about nothing today. And it's like, no.
Your appointment as host was surprising to just about everyone, including you. We know that Jon Stewart's first choice was John Oliver to get him back, and that didn't work out. Did you feel in any way slightly less grateful that you weren't the first choice?
Why? Why? Most of us are not the first choice in our lives. Most of the people who are married to someone because it's not their first choice.
Is that true?
That is life.
You know that for a fact?
I know that for a fact. I'm willing to put money down.
Give me the data on that.
I'm willing to put money down on that. Think of it like this. If Will Smith didn't turn down The Matrix, Keanu Reeves would have never made it. Like that is, I always think that that's what life is. It is somebody who turns something down and then you get to pick it up and go, let me try this, you know? And I would have gone with John Oliver. I love John Oliver till this day. John Oliver is one of the reasons that I was like, I would like to do the show. John Oliver was one of the people I looked up to, because before him, I had never seen a non-American doing anything like that. And it took him a good 10 years to get good at doing that. Mm. So I aspire to be as good as John Oliver. So I'm never, oh no, no, that's something I'm never slated by, because I, if that was the case, you'd never be grateful for anything in life.
And circumstances being what they are, you've done well on the show and the ratings have improved. That said, it's easy for people to compare you at the beginning of your Hitch here with Jon Stewart at the end, which is not a fair comparison, but the way, you know, time works,
yes,
it's a natural thing to do. So talk for a minute about that. What pressures you're feeling, if any, from the network to improve ratings?
I've been very lucky in that the network has always been supportive of us. And most importantly, because you must remember, we never lost ratings. We just never had the ratings of 16-year Jon Stewart, which in essence would be an insult to Jon Stewart, I always think. I go like, can you imagine if you come in from nowhere, nobody knows you, and the ratings are exactly the same?
Oh, it must have just been the time slot. It wasn't you at all, Jon.
Then you go like, oh, so what? So Jon didn't mean anything? I would hope that Jon leaving would change the ratings. And I would hope that that would then give me an opportunity to build up to something myself, to see some growth, to see what a base is, and to go, okay, I can work up from here.
So let me just go back a little bit to you taking over for Jon and you being a very different person, very different thinker, and so on. You presented and I think talked a little bit about the fact that you're not as angry a person or don't play that person so much. And I'm just curious whether the election of Trump has changed your kind of internal mandate for how to manage or dial up perhaps the anger.
Not necessarily. And I'll tell you why. And this is the thing that people make a mistake with, because they try and make it an either or.
Mm-hmm.
They go, oh, you're not as angry as John, and you say you're not as angry.
Right.
But if you listen to what John said was, he said, I have become too angry. I have become tired of being angry. I can no longer do this. I understand that you want a comedy show, but I do not possess that. And he said to me, the show needs a host that still has that energy and still has the ability to find the comedy and use it as a tool to cut through everything that is presented to them. And so my anger happens in bursts, but I do not exist only as an angry person. And maybe it's because of the world I grew up in, where anger and strategy had to be balanced. You know, in South Africa, we had many struggle leaders who were angry, but you had to learn when to let that anger come out. These are the things I've learned from some of the greatest leaders, just reading their autobiographies and their stories. I also learned this when I used to box. You know, I didn't box professionally, but as a boxer, you have to learn to calm down. You're trying to win. Your anger doesn't help you win. There are moments when you can use it to fuel what you're trying to do, but half of the time, it sends you into a blind rage.
Do you think President Obama could have used a little more anger? Or do you think he played things generally well? Because obviously he was frustrated and he expressed his frustration very eloquently for 8 years.
Yeah.
But he didn't pound on tables and so on.
I think hindsight is 20/20. I think everyone will know how Obama should have done it because it was never done before. And we won't have an example until maybe another black president does it again.
You interviewed President Obama in the White House shortly before he left office. So for a guy who grew up very poor in South Africa, that was obviously a very unlikely outcome that you'd end up in the White House. How do you process that?
Wow. I can only be grateful. I sat with my friends afterwards and we just talked about it, you know, and, you know, one of my friends, Trayvon, who used to be a writer on The Daily Show, him and I were just chatting and he was like, do you understand how insane this is? You are the host of The Daily Show. He's the president, but you are both mixed race people who are both half African. You grew up under apartheid. He's now the president. Like the fact that you guys met, do you know how unlikely, just in terms of odds and numbers.
Yeah, even meeting anywhere, much less at the White House.
At the White House, right. You interviewing him. I mean, it was.
And him telling you that you're the good looking one, by the way.
You know, I will say that I resent how young and good looking you are, because I used to think of myself in those terms, and it's been downhill for quite some time.
Look, I think it's moments like that that I try to cherish as much as possible.
Let's say I'm Donald Trump. You land me on your show.
Yes.
First question for me?
First question for you. Let me think. Landed you on the show. You've come in as president.
I come to you, Trevor Noah, because I've heard that you are a really interesting thinker, a straight shooter, and that you look at things differently, as do I.
I would probably say, you really knew how to tap into almost everybody's anger and feelings of being left behind and sometimes even of hatred. How did you do that without getting swept up in it? Because you don't believe most of those things.
Now, what makes you think, though, that I wouldn't hear that the beginning of that and say, you did well at tapping into the anger? Wouldn't my response naturally then be, well, that's an accusation?
Oh, no,
it wasn't
Donald,
anger.
Donald Trump doesn't think like
no,
that.
He doesn't.
No, 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 no. You're going too deep now. No.
Okay, so what would my reply be then? Now you have to be Trump and I'll be you for a moment.
What would Trump say to that? Trump will go, he'll probably say, I traveled around the country, met a lot of people, fantastic people, tremendous people, tremendous people. You know, a lot of angry people. I heard what they said. And, you know, these people, they want to change. And we're going to, you know, that's what we're going to do. We're going to make America great again. We're going to make America great again.
What do you think of Trump?
I think Donald Trump is playing a character in a reality show. And he doesn't take it as seriously as everyone else does. That's what I genuinely think.
Therefore, the outcome will be poor, or therefore the outcome will be, it's hard to say because we've never seen it before.
It's hard to say because we've never seen it. I've never seen this before. You know, normally the show ends when the person wins the prize. Now it's the beginning of the journey.
In case you are still undecided on Trevor Noah, and you want to know more about where he stands on the pressing issues of the day?
I have studied this for a very long time, and I've come to the conclusion that people who refuse to listen to Freakonomics Radio are unfortunately doomed to be labeled as idiots. Now, this is something we can all change, but it's all up to you.
So congratulations, dear listener. You have proven that you are not an idiot. Why don't you help your friends and family escape idiocy, too, by telling them to listen and do the other nice things to support our show? Coming up on Freakonomics Radio, Trevor Noah, of course, is an immigrant to the United States. What country would you guess produces, on average, some of the most successful immigrants in the world?
What you find, on average, is that in terms of PhDs, they are usually as many as 3 Lebanese Americans who have PhDs to every 1 sort of general population American who has a PhD. So they're really a much higher rate. So on average, I think you will find the most Lebanese Americans, and really actually, by the way, most Arab Americans, tend to be more highly educated than the general population.
That's coming up on Freakonomics Radio.
From WNYC Studios, this is Freakonomics Radio. Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
Once upon a time, I was on a plane with Nassim Taleb. He's a philosopher of sorts, and he writes fascinating books, most recently The Black Swan and Anti-Fragile.
Hello, I'm Nassim Taleb. I'm an author and I would say a statistical engineer.
Now, Taleb is originally from Lebanon. He still goes back a few times a year. He lives just outside of New York City now. And on this plane trip, he told me something I'd never heard before, which was that if you look at 10 or 20 or 30 of the richest countries around the world, that among the richest people in those countries is someone from Lebanon.
When we met last, we were going from London to South Africa on this beautiful trip with extremely hospitable people. So we were going, and then suddenly we started discussing the Lebanese diaspora.
And when he started talking about this, about how successful the Lebanese diaspora is, I had 3 quick reactions. Number 1, interesting if it's true. 2, is it true? And 3, if true, why?
يسعد صباحك يا حلو يسعد مكان بتنزلو.
So the author Nassim Taleb, who is Lebanese-American, tells us that the Lebanese diaspora has been incredibly successful. And he's got some theories, some deep-seated historical theories as to why that is. But before we get back to him, let's take a closer look at the Lebanese community in the States and elsewhere. We'll start with a friend of mine. His name is George Atala Jr. He works for the NFL Players Association, and he, too, is Lebanese-American.
All right, so George, if there was one person you could think of who could explain the mysteries of Lebanese prominence and prosperity around the world, where would I go?
You'd have to talk to my dad. He is probably as encyclopedic a character as there is on the Lebanese community. You know, my dad used to always tell me stories about, you know, I will use his accent here, the richest guy in Brazil is Lebanese. The most famous guy in Mexico is Lebanese.
I mean, you read on his name, Carlos Slim. I mean, Carlos is Lebanese.
So I called George Atala's dad.
This is Susie Lechtenberg. Hi, Susie.
Hi.
She's a producer on the show.
He was in the midst of a lovely evening when I talked to him.
I mean, I'm sitting by the balcony looking over Beirut and enjoying a nice glass of white wine.
These days he splits his time between New York and Beirut, and basically he echoed much of what his son told you.
So, Susie, tell me a bit more about the Atala family.
Right, so basically they immigrated to the United States after the Civil War broke out in 1975.
I left Lebanon in 1978.
We made our home in Queens, New York.
I was married with a 3-month child.
Okay, so that's little George Atala Jr. he's talking about.
Yep, and the family has this classic bootstrap immigrant tale.
My dad had a high school degree. My mom had a high school degree. Neither of them went to college.
The elder Atala could only speak a few words of English when he arrived in the United States.
My first language is French. My education is French.
Even so, he became super successful. He got a job as a banker, and he started to build up his client base. And how did he do that? By opening a phone book and looking for Lebanese names.
He looked through the white pages, found anybody whose name sounded like it was Lebanese, and called them up out of the blue.
So the idea is, you have a Lebanese last name. Do you want to be my client at my bank?
That's right. And just by looking at their names, he could tell even more about them.
So he recognized where the last names correlated with what parts of Lebanon they were from.
Clearly, this guy knows a thing or two about Lebanese names.
Okay, so when I talked to George Jr., he told me about his father's intense pride in their heritage, and that whenever the name of any successful person comes up, George Sr. tries to claim that person as Lebanese. Is that actually true?
That is definitely true. Are you ready?
Yeah, I'm ready. Go ahead.
Okay, here it goes.
You have so many successful people. You have Casey Kasem, Jamie Farr. Have you heard of Jamie Farr?
Corporal Klinger, isn't it?
Right.
Yeah. Right. Corporal Klinger, right? Unmasked. Yep. Guy who's always trying to get the Section 8. Okay.
I know Jamie Farr.
Uh-huh.
You know who else is Lebanese?
Who else is Lebanese?
Everyone else. Like Marlo Thomas?
Yeah, Marlo, she's the daughter of Danny.
Also Helen Thomas, the former White House correspondent.
Helen. Yeah, Helen, sure. Helen Thomas is Lebanese. Oh, no question.
Nice. Who else?
George Mitchell is part Lebanese. Tony Shalhoub is the Lebanese, yes?
What are you afraid of? Needles, milk, heights, spiders. Sand.
I love Tony Shalhoub from Monk. Great actor. All right, Susie, who else?
Well,
John Sununu, Spencer Abraham, the first governor of Oregon was Atiyeh, Governor Atiyeh. Very successful. The one who started Kinko's is Lebanese. Salma Hayek is Mexican-Lebanese. The heart surgeon, DeBakey, Carlos Ghosn, Joe Hager, Khalil Gibran, Elie Saab. You have one famous scientist also with NASA, but I don't know his name. And who owns the bridge between Canada and Detroit? He's the Lebanese guy, Maroon. Google.
So George Atala Jr. was right. His dad does try to claim just about everyone as Lebanese, even if they might not be.
I mean, I tell you, even athletes, he'll look at his name and he'll say, you know, John Elway is Lebanese. I'll say, what are you talking about? He goes, yes, Alloway, the Alloway family. And we grew up with that all the time. He's just the best when it comes to that stuff. And, you know, we take a lot of pride in our culture. So,
was anybody in your father's view not Lebanese?
Some people were, yes.
Like, give me an example of someone who plainly couldn't be.
Well, even my Irish principal, Mr. Healy, at one point was considered to be Lebanese. So, and he was clearly not.
As for John Elway, the truth is we don't know. His name is listed on a website of prominent Lebanese Americans, but when we tried to ask him directly via the Denver Broncos, where he starred as quarterback and is now an executive, we didn't get an answer. Whatever the case with John Elway, I do understand the Atallah family's pride in all things Lebanese. But just think of the successful Italians and Irish and Swedes in this country. Couldn't we make a big list from any of them? Did you know that Nigerians are one of the most educated immigrant groups in America? Did you know that Slovaks have the highest rate of home ownership? And look at the Jews. Jews make up less than 0.2% of the global population, but more than 20% of all Nobel Prize winners are Jewish. So, is the Lebanese diaspora really that successful?
It's very difficult to sort of say across the board they were the most successful diasporas.
Akram Kader is a professor of Middle Eastern history at North Carolina State University. He moved here from Lebanon in 1978 during a long and brutal civil war. While Kader tells us that the Lebanese may not be the most successful diaspora, the data show that, at least in the U.S., they are doing pretty well.
There's no doubt that if you look at the statistics today, and this is from the census, the Lebanese community, on average, they actually do seem to have, in terms of economic measures, on average, bigger houses. They are more professional in terms of their employment. They have better income. So if one is to take that as a measure, then they're fairly highly successful, yes.
In the United States, median household income is about $56,000. For Lebanese Americans, $75,000. Pretty impressive. So what else? Everyone we talked to for this episode had an opinion as to why the Lebanese diaspora is so successful. George Atallah Sr. thinks that success simply courses through their veins.
You know, maybe in their gene, Lebanese has in his blood, he's a hardworking, he likes to improve his life, and he has some network that he can count on. If he wants to go into business, I mean, he can call a cousin in Brazil or a sister in Africa or whatever. So the network is very important. Plus, he blends in society and adapts very well.
And here's his son, also George, who works for the NFL Players Association.
We tend to trace it back to the folklore of our Phoenician merchant days. All that's part of our history. And I think we pride ourselves on our relationship with people. That's really what I would attribute it to.
Akram Kader, the historian at NC State, pinpoints two pivotal moments in Lebanese history. The country had two major waves of emigration. The first ran from about 1880 to 1920.
The Christians of Lebanon left because they were being persecuted by the Ottoman authorities.
But religious persecution was just one reason.
The reality is the predominant reason they left is economic. And specifically what happened in that time period is that the Lebanese economy had become very dependent on silk production.
Kader says a crash in the silk market drove people into poverty and, subsequently, out of the country. The next exodus came during Lebanon's civil war, which began in 1975. 40% of the population left the country.
And basically, the violence led to severe economic difficulties and instabilities between 1975 and 1990. And so what you find is that these university graduates were sitting there trying to figure out what to do, and they could not find jobs, so they would leave.
So these highly educated, middle-class Lebanese fled to places like Brazil, Argentina, Canada, the U.S., South Africa, and Australia, which is what leads us to one of the most interesting things about the Lebanese diaspora.
If you look at the diaspora community, you, with these two waves that I spoke about, the 1880 to 1920, we think somewhere around 360,000 left from that time period. And if you, you know, sort of multiply by about three, four generations, you know, I mean, you can't really get an accurate number, but by three, four generations, you're looking at about maybe 2 to 3 million globally. Then, of course, from 1975 forward, you have another 1.7 million that left. So, ostensibly, there are at least as many Lebanese outside Lebanon as there are within Lebanon.
There are roughly 6 million people living in Lebanon today. Now, we've seen estimates that as many as 15 to 20 million people of Lebanese descent live outside the country. And when they leave, Lebanese stick together. They network. They work hard. They place a lot of emphasis on education, which segues into highly skilled and highly paid jobs.
I think what you find is the two major areas are engineering and medicine. Those were sort of, for myself speaking personally here, you know, I'm part of the 1970, post-1975. I came here in 1978. And at the time that I was attending high school, basically every good Lebanese boy, every good Arab boy, really had to be a doctor or an engineer. Those were the two venues of success. Those were your entry points into middle and upper middle class. That's how you would succeed.
Akram Kader did become an engineer, but he was also interested in the humanities. He studied history and, somewhat unusually, women's studies. He is, in fact, the only double major in engineering and women's studies we have ever come across.
I don't know. I have to be quite honest, and I don't know if I should say this, but you know, the truth of the matter is I took the women's studies course because they told me there are a lot of girls in the class.
So the Lebanese success story really does seem to be about a certain kind of entrepreneurial spirit. But Nassim Taleb says it's more than that. Taleb, you remember, is a Lebanese-American author, most recently of a book called Anti-Fragile, Things That Gain from Disorder. In his view, Lebanon itself and the Lebanese have, in some ways, gained from disorder.
The idea is that in natural setting, anything natural, anything organic, anything biological, up to a point, reacts a lot better to stressors than without. Mm-hmm. So in other words, now, for example, I'm talking to you on this line. If the line has some noise on it, a little bit of mess here and there, and there's a little bit of noise, then the listeners will grasp the message a lot better and remember it longer. You need a little bit of adversity results in things, or a little bit of strain, a little bit of stress, that result in a little more performance on anything.
And explain in the case of the phone line why that is.
You switch from what Daniel Kahneman calls system one to system two, or the reverse, whatever. From one system where you're sort of passive and not making an effort to an effortful one. Mm. And that switch takes place via a stressor. So, you know, you prune a tree, it grows stronger, you see. It's the same kind of response, but in a different domain. And when you and I were on a plane, the conversation was definitely about this anti-fragile reaction by people who, when they face adversity, exile, they tend to fare better when you go in the state of diaspora. And then we got to South Africa, and sure enough, the Lebanese diaspora there is very small, but monstrously successful.
All right, let me ask you this then. We had the Ottoman Empire collapse, and the Levant became Lebanon and Syria, and things changed politically there. Then a very bad civil war in Lebanon in the 1970s, a lot more emigration. And now the situation in Lebanon is changing daily as we speak, but it's rather chaotic with Hezbollah.
It's not chaotic. Let me tell you something, because I go to Lebanon several times a year. I have a place there in my village, which incidentally, and I have a chapter in Anti-Fragile, where I do a very comparative analysis. I went to Abu Dhabi. Mm-hmm. And they were building these universities, hoping to get the people, you know, to have their industrial revolution, stuff like that. And I thought about it. And then I went to my home village that had been destroyed during the war and now has been richer than ever, you see, with a bunch of villas, and then realized the value of stressors. So Lebanon has, you know, you're in the news business. You know what the news are. The news are not about
the anomalies.
About the anomaly, so it's about the lurid.
Yeah.
If you take the homicide rate in Lebanon, okay, including the few problems we've had, it's still considerably lower than the States, mm-hmm. and vastly lower than Brazil. Okay? Mm. So it's much more stable than we think. Now, the other thing about being anti-fragile, Lebanon hasn't gone through war I think it has some immunity to war, because every time you think the whole thing is going to collapse, like in Syria, nothing happens. And effectively, in the Black Swan, I was warning against pseudo-stability, Syria. The more you stabilize a place, the more a place seems non-chaotic, like today Saudi Arabia, the more it's going to have problems. Or look at Egypt, all right? It was very stable. Lebanon, on the other hand, is continuous fear of chaos, and yet it's very stable. If you look at, if you forget the news and just look on the ground, you see a remarkable stability, even prosperity in spite of everything.
So in Taleb's view, the Lebanese people have developed an inner stability, an inner drive to succeed even, because of a continued fear of chaos. Now, as interesting as you may find his thesis, you may also be tempted to argue with it. There are plenty of countries where chaos and war didn't leave behind a population that was ready to take on the world. Quite the opposite, in fact. But the success of Lebanese immigrants around the world is indeed something to admire. We should also note, however, that when we talk about the success of one or another group of immigrants, we should focus on one key component of that equation. These were people who immigrated. Here again is North Carolina State historian Akram Kader.
The first thing that I would say is that anybody who immigrates is already a self-selecting population. In other words, when you make the decision, and this kind of goes on a larger notion, our understanding of immigration is of these sort of desperate souls that are clinging to lifeboats and arriving here and just that's it. It's a very nice narrative, but it's a false narrative. In fact, most people, whether we're talking about the great migration of the 19th century or the current migration, Hispanics, what have you, they don't come here beyond the fact that most of them, the great majority of them, come here to make money. With the full intention of going back, by the way. And if you look at the rate of return in the 19th century, that great migration period, you know, whether you're talking about Germans with 80% return rate or Northern Italians with about 60% or Southern Italians with 30% or even the Lebanese with about 37%, these people came here. They uprooted themselves from their culture, from their family, from the familiar world they exist in. Many of them, especially in the turn of the 20th century, many of them were not even a word of English. And, you know, today it's a little bit better, but still people are arriving in this whole new alien place in which they had to have to adjust in all sorts of ways. They're coming here specifically to make money. So it takes a particular kind of individual to do that, right? I mean, it takes somebody who is already self-selecting. So you're looking at a population that is, you know, has the tools, that sort of entrepreneurial, adventurous, pioneering spirit, personality, mentality. And so that already prepares them to undertake this incredibly risky process, investment, if you will. Now, I must hasten to add, by the way, that not everybody succeeded.
It's a great point that Kader makes. When you look at a big group of people or a big pile of data, our attention is often captured by the bright, shiny success stories, and we forget about everyone that failed. This is called survivorship bias. Let's say I were to ask you to name a high-tech company that started in a garage. What company comes to mind? Depending on your age, you might say Apple, you might say Hewlett-Packard. But what about the thousands and thousands of other people who started tech companies in their garages and failed? They're pretty much forgotten. So, the fact that you are alive to listen to this program means that someone, somewhere in your family tree, survived. Maybe they beat some long odds. Maybe they escaped war or an economic depression or saber-toothed tiger out for lunch. In any case, congratulations, you made it. And if you happen to also be Lebanese, hey, double congratulations. I'm Stephen Dubner, and that was Freakonomics Radio. Thanks for listening. We will be back next week. If you cannot wait that long, you can find our entire Freakonomics Radio podcast archive at freakonomics.com or at iTunes, where you can also subscribe.